Okay. I can begin. You hear me?
Yep, go.
Okay, good. Great. All right, today is Monday, June 29th, 1919. I'll tell you, it's 1961. June 29th, 2020, but June 29th, 1961, I became a father. So today is a very important date in my life. I want to say Boker Tov, Mevorach, to those sitting on the screen in front of me, all parts of the world. For some of you, it's the middle of the night. And I want to say all good wishes to my many students across the face of the Jewish people. We want to pick up today with the RCA, and we're dealing with Kashrut. And there's no question that what began very slowly in the 1920s, by the 1950s, is a very proud achievement of rabbinical council. A bitter fight was fought for years with personal hashgachot, Rabbis Reichman and Chalap, who later become well known for all their hashgachot in the New York area, were determined to hold on to the right to give a personal hashgacha. Ultimately, the RCA, by an overwhelming majority, finally voted that any member of the RCA has to waive this right. And it probably was the greatest achievement of OU, RCA, in even, I would say, until today, where rabbis voluntarily and willingly gave up the right to make money, waived it for the good of the general concept, and the OU takes off. Now, at this point, the OU does not have its own poskim. It has rabbis, it has people who know kashrut, but when a difficult question comes up, they return to the Rabbinical Council of America Commission of Halakha. This changed over the years when the OU became bigger and bigger and more shilas and more shilas. And you will know that today the posek for the OU is Reb Heschel Schechter. Reb Asher Weiss is also involved. He took the place of Reb Meir Belsky of Teira Vadas. And today they have their own poskim. What do you say? Oh, I'm being corrected. I know Reb Meir Belsky person. It's Reb Yisrael Belsky, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Torah Vadas and who was the posek for the OU. Yomo, thank you for the correction. And today they have their own poskim. But one of the interesting shilas that came up with Tide. Now, Tide, I don't know, is it still on the market today? When I was growing up, Tide was a very well-known brand of detergent. And it plays a role in Torah history because how many of you know what Tides was? Tides was Torim Derech Eretz Society. One of the organizers was one of my good friends in life, Professor Elma Affenbacher, Zichrona Livracha. And they took the word tides, a play on tide. Now, you would wonder, why is there a shiloh with tide? It's a detergent used in the washing machine. But there once was a time where people also washed clothes in the sink. I live, Baruch Hashem, in my house. I have two sinks, milchiks, fleishiks. We didn't grow up that way. We grew up with one sink, and at times that sink also, they washed baby clothes occasionally, socks, whatever, and they used the detergent. So Tide wanted to put in 0.5% of glycerin. And evidently this glycerin, again, I'm not a chemist, but it seems it pops up in many different food items. And here with the detergent, it seemed it gave the detergent more strength. And of course, glycerin for a detergent, they're not going to use the more expensive vegetable glycerin, which is basically the glycerin that's used today in all the kosher products. And they want to use animal glycerin. And this shiloh was referred to the Halachic Commission, and they permitted it. Why did they permit it? First of all, it's 0.5%, so it's batel, mevutal, nullified. On the other hand, Ein Mevatlin Isa Lachatchila, those of you who have learned Yoredeya, so how can you ab initio say, put in 0.5%. But there's another factor involved, which has very, very many contemporary important implications in Kashrut, that the glycerin, by the time it was put into the detergent, it was totally changed, its entire form, totally, whatever chemical reaction it went through, it's not recognizable as the original glycerin. If that's the case, Ein Mevatlin Isa Lachatchila does not apply. Now, this has very interesting implications because, take a look, kosher gelatin, which is a problem that to a certain degree haunted us in the 20th century. And I remember whenever we would try to bother the Rev about the Shaila, he would say, don't bother me with kosher gelatin. You know, it was a tremendous machloket ha-poskim. Reb Chaim Moshe was matir, the Rav was matir, others were matir. And of course, many acid, and on a personal level, the idea of having bones from treif animals in my gelatin didn't appeal to me. But halakhically speaking, you can make a case that these bones are so pulverized, so changed, that it's davar chadash, it's not the original product. And this was part of the glycerin. And this is one example where the halakhic commission paskin lahalacha for the OU. Nowadays, a shaila like this, they could handle internally. There are endless Talmidei Chachamim, Rabbanim, Rav Menachem Ginnack, and others who work full-time for the OU. And if it's a shaila where they want, Echad Migedolei Yisrael, so it will be passed on to Rav Heschel or to Rav Asher Weiss. All right, then there's another problem that comes up. And this, too, is a problem that haunts us until this very minute. It came up in the State of Israel as well. And this problem is very simple. What do you do if a conservative temple comes to you and they want hashgacha on their caterer? And here you have a glatt kosher caterer in a conservative temple. I need not tell you that this shaila repeats itself. So there are two ways to view it. One way to view it is, look, if you're giving hashgacha in a conservative temple, the world is not that learned, not that sophisticated. The oilim is a goilim. Hahamonim heim chamorim. And, you know, life has taught me there's a certain truth to this. I need not tell you. False news, etc. So you're giving hashgacha, conservative temple, it means not just the caterer, you're giving hashgacha that the temple is beseda. The other way to look at it, of course, is our hashgacha is just on the caterer. What does it have to do with the temple? Halavai, the caterer should be kosher. The more kosher places we have, the more people who will eat kosher. Halavai, every temple and every reform temple, that the caterer should be under proper hashgacha. And this problem came up, and here the OU made a decision that more important to give hashgacha, we have to state hashgacha is on the caterer. Any intelligent human being would understand it's not on the temple, it's on the caterer. Where did this come up again? So let me tell you one of my great shocks. Herbie, I used to say only in Israel could this happen. It was during my original years here as an Alech Hadash, when you're absorbing the Israeli scene for better or for worse. And the truth is, you never really become a total Israeli, but I've done pretty well considering my many years in the Israeli army and my battle ribbon and my work for the Mossad. So more or less, I've done very well. That DiMaggio is still the little devil in my body, and that's a modern Hebrew word I learned just over the weekend. Maybe I'll tell you about it at the end. The Shedon in my body. All right, that's part of life. That's a Ramban in HaChodesh HaZalachem Rosh Chodashim, and it's nothing to be upset about. If anything, you should be proud to know where you came from. So here I am, and I open up the Maariv, and I have to say that from the day I came in Aliyah, I used to read Maariv faithfully every Friday to, improve my Hebrew and master what's going on here. So I see a headline, a policeman was injured, lost control of his motorcycle on this past Shabbat. Why? He was driving the motorcycle on King David Street, and he sees a guy jump onto a motorcycle with a kippah on his head on King David Street. And he was flabbergasted, a guy with a kippah jumping on a motorcycle on Shabbat. It turned out that this was outside the Hebrew Union College on King David Street. And this was a Reform Jew, a guy studying for the rabbinate here from America for a year of study. And of course, for a Reform Jew, there's no Shabbat, there's no halacha, no problem with a motorcycle. And this poor policeman was flabbergasted. Now, this Hebrew Union College comes up with the same shaila. They have a caterer, and they wanted hashgacha from the Rabbanut. This must go back to the 80s, maybe the 70s, late 70s. And in order for their catering hall to thrive, they needed a proper hashgacha. Without a proper hashgacha, it's Yerushalayim, you're not going to get that many affairs. So then the shaila came up. There was a big outcry within the Moetza Datid that they didn't want to give hashgacha. I have to say that we American rabbis, we already had a Rabbinical Council of America active here. If you look into Rakafet Aaron, either Chelik Aleph, Chelik Bet, I did a whole article on the Rabbinical Council of America in Israel, its initial years. And we spoke with the rabbinate and we told them, look, we told them exactly what happened in America and exactly what the RCA OU did in America. And adarabba, you give hashgacha, more people will eat kosher. You make clear your hashgacha is only on the caterer. And I believe until today, there's a reliable hashgacha in the Hebrew Union College. I can tell you in America, in Lawrence, I still recall going to weddings in the big Reform temple a few blocks away from Shaarei Tefillah. And mamish, you come into the temple, you feel you're in a church. It has no atmosphere of a shul. It's mamish, a Reform temple from the old days. But the hashgacha there, glat kosher. Today already, the temple, it only survived over the years because of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry drove in from all over Long Island, but that doesn't last more than 20, 30 years. Today, if you know in Lawrence, part of it has now become a Jewish center. It's non-denominational already, and one day there'll be a big yeshiva there. I don't want to predict because I don't want to be a shoteb, but just common sense, Jack. I can't read it. It doesn't happen. Yomo, can you read that? Can you read that? No, Yomo can't read it either. So it's not just that my eyes are older. Okay. We have arrived. Where's Yitz Rubin? Yitz, okay. I see your name. Yitzchak is with us. We have arrived. Gentlemen, nobody enjoys something more than a good piece of candy. And I need not tell you, chocolate and coffee, I don't know in ancient times, but in modern times, these are two of the most popular food items in the world. You will not go broke if you open up a good candy company and produce a good product. The United States of America, when I was growing up, and many of you will recall this, you didn't look for hashgacha, you looked for ingredients on candy, and generally speaking, most candy was kosher. I need not tell you, the people in Kashrut will confirm this, that candy, chocolate we're talking about, is probably the easiest food product to give hashgacha on. All right, pure chocolate with emulsifier, they're limited halachic problems. Later, they can add certain things. That becomes more troublesome. But there's candy and this candy. I need not tell you, anyone who grew up in America, a Hershey candy bar, anyone who grew up in Israel, the para, the cow on the bar. That was the symbol of great, great candy. But this is candy on a popular level. In Hungary, it seems they developed candy, each candy handmade, hand-dipped, each candy something special. It's like here before Hanukkah, all the sufganiyot, it now became, we were growing up, a sufganiyah was a little cake with some jelly in it. Today, you look at the sufganiyot, just to look at them, you grow fat. I'm not even talking about eating them. Just to look at them, you gain weight. So there were specialized candy companies in America. I'll give you an example, Loft. How many of you remember the name Loft's Candy? They were very special. They were the biggest, outside of candy you bought in the store, they were biggest outlet of candy, had many chains. Were they kosher or not? I frankly don't remember. But I do know that Saturday night, a lot of good Jews, after they went to the movies, there was no computer then, there was no television. The movies were built like luxury theaters, Palace, RKO Palace, Fordham Palace. Oh, wow. And afterwards, you went out to Loft's Candy and you had an ice cream soda with some candy. Well, a Jew arrived in America, a Hungarian refugee by the name of Stephen Klein. He was the most famous. There was a brother involved in the business as well. And these people evidently knew the art of how to make very special candy. And they saw in the United States for kosher people, there was no candy on a level that was 100% acceptable. And they opened up a little candy manufacturing and they sold their own candy. See, this is the key to the conflict that happens. But let me explain myself. Today, you want candy. All right, I tell my daughter whenever, and my daughter does our shopping now, of course, where to use, I told you, modern Hebrew, gil sikun. I love the new words they invent here. Gil sikun, machlat reka, baruch Hashem. Machlok Reka, I played innocent outside of kneecaps, which I don't affect, don't have anything to do with corona. But Gil Sikun, Ani Modela Emet, Malasot, Emet Viyatsiv. So I tell her when you see a candy bar, they're putting out now 30 less sugar. And it's very good. I love the one with the coconut in it, the one with the nuts in it. Beautiful. But see, these are candy bars you buy in a supermarket. We're talking about candy only available in specialty stores. Now, Barton's went out and organized a chain of stores, but much more than that. Here we are in the United States. The year is the late 40s, early 50s. We're talking about an America where the third and fourth generation are reform and are intermarrying already. We're talking about a time when the conservative movement, and this we'll talk about in the news, Man Be'ezrat Hashem, the conservative movement is all powerful. It's like the New York Yankees of 1927. What you're dealing with, the conservative movement, wow. And here comes along a refugee family and they establish outlets that are Shomer Shabbos 100% kosher. You have no idea what guts this took and what a Kiddush Hashem. Today you say, well, what's the big deal? Shomer Shabbos, every store on 13th Avenue is Shomer Shabbos. What you don't know is that my mother's second marriage was to Reb Moshe Appelbach, Zichrona Livracha. He was president. He was a lawyer, American born. I got smicha with one son, graduated college with another son. Go and dream. Our father and mother would be Zivik Sheni for both of them. And very beautiful second marriage. So Moshe told me, Maris Appelbach, we would call him, that he was president of the Shomer Shabbos organization in Borough Park. They would go from store to store on 13th Avenue, pleading with them to close for Shabbos. Pleading. I mean, you don't understand that today. Who is Shomer Shabbos? This is 13th Avenue Borough Park, where there already was a Teredic community. So here you have Barton's to plant the Shomer Shabbos, the outlet stores of Shomer Shabbos. Many of the workers are refugees that they took in Shomer Shabbos Yidden. What a Kiddush Hashem. Now, there's another side to the story. Who remembers on Rehov Hillel ben Mordechai, if I'm pronouncing it right, the center of Yerushalayim? Is it Ben Hillel? What's it called? Ben Mordechai? I forget already. It connects King George with Ben Yehuda. Mordechai Ben Hillel, I think it is. All right. Anyway, so that little street, there was a bakery right in the middle of the street. And we're Olim Chadashim, and I see half of Mei Sharim, anyone who had a little money in Mei Sharim, they're buying in that bakery. And I got to tell you, their products were mashahu, lav me olam hadein, out of this world. And we go in, Americans, stupid Americans, it's 50 years ago, and 51 years ago already, it'll soon be 52 years, time flies. And we say, yesh kan hashgacha, they threw us out, like we're insulting them. They had the mentality, the hashgacha is us, the family. You know us? If you know us, you're not going to ask what hashgacha we have. And by the way, this is absolutely true. Anyone who's involved in hashgacha, there's no way that a hashgacha can be 100% of the time. If the balabas is edel, you got hashgacha. If the balabas is devious, you can be the greatest mashgiach in the world. Sehelfnish. I don't have to tell you what went on with the chicken man in Muncie under Hasidish Hashgacha. God have mercy. And I know the man. Believe me, when that Rebbe, when that scandal broke, he vowed never to give Hashgacha again. And boy, when I met this man and I got to know him, he befriended, I didn't know who he was, then they told me, how can you give Hashgacha? Who can you trust more than a Yidmet Abad who learns the Daf Yomi, a Bal Korei Mumcha? Go and dream at 12 o'clock in the morning. He becomes at 12 o'clock midnight. He sits in his truck and becomes a devil. So Barton's had no Hashgacha. Barton's had no Hashgacha. No, do you need Hashgacha? Refugees, Shema Shabbos, Shema Kashrut, Makadshe Shem Shemayim. You need Hashgacha? Okay. And this was fine and good. Nothing to do with the OU. This was the reality of Jewish life. My wife still remembers that it was her birthday, or it was the Afikomen, I should say. She won an Afikomen, and her grandfather gave her money to go with her mother to see her first movie. And as a special treat, Chol HaMoed Pesach, they could go to Barton's and get kosher Le Pesach ice cream. This was fine. This was good. Quiet, stille hate, nothing to do with the OU. At the same time, there was another family, also of Hungarian origins, I'm told. Excellent candy manufacturers. And they had a series of stores. And they also sold a very high-grade product, Barasini's. Does anyone remember the name? There were three brothers. Good, good. I'm sorry. I'm glad you see I'm not making it up. there were a number of brothers involved, and these were Jews, but these were typical, you talk about Hungarian Jews, God have mercy, some remained from, and some became totally, completely assimilated. You can't generalize, yesh v'yesh. And one of the brothers had a Jewish neshama. I believe his first name was Max. I'll check it later. And he wanted hashgacha for his stores, for his product. And here you have a very interesting situation. Here is what's essentially a family business owned by Jews with a plant that manufactures, with stores that retail, franchises, let's use that word, and they want to know you. Why do they want to know you? On their candy. And as I said, to give an OU on fancy candy, not difficult. The more fancy the candy is, the easier hashgacha, because there are no foreign elements in it. Whatever you put in is pure and basic, and hashgacha can come very easily. And here's Barasini's. Fine. Give them hashgacha. Give them an OU. What's wrong? Another candy place for Jewish kids to enjoy, people after movies, Barasini's, great. Barton's got wind of it, and they turned to the OU, and evidently what was on their mind, and this is the real world. It's not the world I live in, a world of scholarship, of learning, of Torah, of the Elu V'Elu, Divrei Elokim Chayim. Here you're dealing with money. Money is honey. The more money, the better. Mishe yesh lo money, rotze matayim. This is life. You all know what Karl Marx's theories were. And Bartner's got wind of it. And here, what are you going to have? You're going to have a kosher product candy with an OU. And the stores are open Shabbos. And here's Barton's. All his stores are family owned. They're not franchises. They're branches. And they'll undercut their business. And they went to the OU. We want an OU. On condition, you don't give hashgacha to Barasini's. We'll take the OU. Break your contract with Barasini's. We'll pay whatever money you have to give them. But we are Shomer Shabbos. Our plant is Shomer Shabbos. Our stores are Shomer Shabbos. Don't undermine what we are doing. Don't give our competition an OU when they come nowhere near the standards of the totality of Yiddishkeit that we represent. Well, my dear students, Mark, I ask you, what would you do? What would you do? Mark, I have a lot of Marks looking at me. What would you do? Fred, what would you do? Charlie? No, think about this. See, it's not black and white. It's not black and white. I want you to know that this question haunted the OU for a number of years. It went back and forth. It went back and forth. It pitted rabbi against rabbi. And I want you to know the Rav, according to Rabbi Louis Bernstein, And the little, we have very little written material, but according to Rabbi Louis Bernstein, the Rav was in favor, give Barasini's the Hashgacha. You talk about a factory. Well, certainly it's mainly Jewish owned, but it was a corporation. You can do a Shtam Mechira, shift the gears to the Gentile investors, get the revenue from what happens on Shabbat. The stores are franchised. It's no longer your responsibility. But the product itself will be strictly kosher. And remember, now you come along and get involved with all the modern hashgacha. Who says that many of these food producers are not Jewish-owned, partially Jewish-owned, partially Jewish stock? Where do you draw the line? Where do your demands begin? Where do your demands end? And Max Barasini was willing to meet the OU. He said it has to be a gradual process. And he explained very interestingly that Barton's began with refugees, Shomrei Shabbos. They're willing to work on Sunday. So the plan, Barton's, certainly he was closed Shabbos. Before Pesach, believe me, he was manufacturing on Sunday. Barasini's, which had been around for more than 20 years at the time, their workers, who's going to work Sunday? Their whole mentality, Gentile or Jew, was Sunday is the day off. You all know what we Americans suffered when we came in Aliyah 50 years ago. Ask Arnie Rothkopf, what's it like to live in Israel? I used to say there are two Mondays. Sunday is Monday and Monday is Monday. Right or wrong? We all experienced that. No, Barasini said, gradually he's willing to hire Shomer Shabbos people who will be willing to work on Sunday so that ultimately he can switch the entire manufacturing process till Sunday. Well, this was a battle royal. What do you do? I want to quote Rabbi Bernstein to you because it's a very sharp quote. Stephen Klein was a refugee of Nazi Europe and came to America where he established the Barton's Company. An observant Jew who gave liberally to causes that were close to him. He was a founder of a yeshiva high school for girls, which eventually became Yeshiva University's Central High School. It's the original, the one in Manhattan. Not the original one, the original one was in Brooklyn, but this was in Manhattan. It doesn't exist now for many decades. He gave liberally to Chinuch Atzmai. They're good at Israel's school system in Israel. His contacts were many and varied. And some of his business associates were also men of means and influence. In other words, he put the pressure on the OU. The Morning Journal now was the only New York Yiddish paper that was Shomer Shabbos. The editor was David Meckler, who was pro-Torah. He called the RCA, OU, what's going on here? I hear complaints that you're being machshir Chilul Shabbos. What are you doing to Barton's? And at a joint meeting of the Kashrut and Halacha Committee, Rosenberg, that's Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg, the head of the OU Kashrut now, reported being pressured by prominent rabbinic figures while others warned him against favorable action four Barasinis. Never before or after do we find these disinterested men involved in Kashrut and Shabbat-related issues. Some of the pressure came from people whose causes and institutions were beneficiaries of Klein's philanthropy. You can understand what's going on here. Klein's techniques were not always refined. And David Hollander tells the following story. There was a crucial meeting, November 1952, a closed Kashrut meeting at the Riverside Plaza Hotel. That's where the RCA met, in one of their conference rooms. Do you remember the Riverside Plaza Hotel? How many of you got married there? I got married there. Vic, how many times did you play at a simcha there? No? The Upper West Side, the Riverside Plaza. That was high class at the time. And they're having this meeting where the Rabbinical Council finally voted on November 5th, 1952 to continue Barasini's Heksha. Standing outside the room where the rabbis met with Stephen Klein, he carried a yellow pad and checked off the names of the rabbis as they came out. He challenged Hollander for favoring the Barasini Pact. So you start to get a feeling of what happened. Like, what's your problem? They do. Can you hear me? You're almost giving me a hard time. They say they can hear me. So. Okay, better? Okay. Yomo is listening on, so he's correct. Still a problem, he says. One second, how's that? Okay. Anyway, this machloikis went on for a number of years. They had the hashgacha and Barasinis. They gave the hashgacha, but they started putting conditions on that you have to kasher the plant. It can't work on Shabbos. I mean, kasher it in the sense of Shmirat Shabbat. And ultimately, Barasinis got fed up and walked away from the Heksha. What happened was the one brother who was really interested, Max, died suddenly. With his death, the other brothers were absolutely fed up with the demands of the OU, and they walked away. It's not worth the effort, the toil, the sorrow, the financial outlay, closing on Shabbos. Forget it. If we can't have the OU, we waive. Martins, of course, went on with the OU. The fight within RCA, OU continued. And then an atom bomb dropped. And that atom bomb, remember it like yesterday, suddenly Martins announces all their stores are up for sale. They're going to be franchised, not family owned. Shabbat, not our responsibility. Turns out that Stephen Klein went to Reb Aaron Cutler. We're talking now the mid-50s. Lakewood is Lakewood. Lakewood is on the map. Reb Aaron Cutler is Reb Aaron Cutler, the Sklitzke Rosh Yeshiva. And he told Stephen Klein, there's no Shiloh. Halachically, you manufacture. The plant is kosher. The plant is Shomer Shabbos. The minute you franchise, you're distributing. You're no longer responsible for what a franchise store does. And suddenly, overnight, the concept of a Barton's branch of the family, Shemesh Shabbos, disappeared, dissolved itself, and there were endless branches of Barton's, Chilul Shabbos, rampant, nothing to do with Jewish neighborhoods anymore. You went into the big stores, the fancy stores, and you would find a section among the candy, Barton's, a franchise. Could get this type of candy, that type of candy, and the middle Barton's. And exactly what Barasini's did with their stores, Barton's was doing a few months later. And this, I would say, heartache haunted the RCA for years to come. Whenever the RCA people of that era would get together, the issue of Barton's and Barasini's, and they didn't hold the fort, they didn't stand up firm, they allowed financial pressure to influence them, and it was exacerbated and exaggerated that a few months after, within 6 months, Barton suddenly did everything that Barasini's did, and Barton's could claim it's a franchise, and they got away with it 100%. Ultimately, what happened with Barasini's and afterwards Barton's, time moved on. The family, you know what happens, the first generation, the second generation still have a family tradition, a family business. The third generation, if those that remain Jewish, a Jewish cup, a Yiddish cup, professors, medical doctors, lawyers, they're not interested in any family business anymore. And Barasini's ultimately sold out to Lofts Candy. And ultimately, Lofts, Barasini's, it all disappeared in the course of time. Barton's too was sold out. And if you recall, Pesach time, Barton's candy appeared on the market. The name was resuscitated, revitalized with an OU. Still, the name Barton's meant something to the Jews who grew up in the 50s, the 60s. And Pesach time, there was a world of Barton's candy available. And then ultimately, I think today, there's no Barton's. I may be wrong. It could be there is something still on Pesach. But my recollection of the last decades, it has dissipated entirely. And the name Barton's, Stephen Klein, become historic figures. But in RCA history, this was a tremendous controversy, second only to the Rabbi Chalap issue. What do you do about individual hashgacha? And what do you do about hashgacha when Jews are involved in the manufacture as well? I need not tell you, in the state of Israel, we have a great bracha, because here the entire manufacture industry is Shemesh Shabbos. It's Shemesh Shabbos, first of all, because the majority of the people involved in food manufacture, by definition, are religious Jews or traditional Jews. You don't find too many professors involved, but Amcha, the Hamon, you find Mesoratiyim. And Shabbos is Shabbos. Who's going to open a plant? It's the official day of rest. I have to tell you, there's another great advantage to Israel. All over the world, when Pesach comes, prices double and prices treble. In the state of Israel, kashrut for Pesach is as natural as breathing air. What do you mean? We're Jews. Of course it has to be kosher. We're not kashering for you, the person who's buying. We're kashering for all of us because we're Jews. We can't work with chametz or sell chametz on Pesach. And so I think you all know, if you've lived here a period of time, that here it's just the opposite. Food prices go down Pesach time. The competition is so great that it's a machaya. I needn't go further than Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola out of Pesach, beginning already right after Purim. Pepsi-Cola, you get 8 bottles for the price of 6. Am I right or wrong? Go into any major store, 8 bottles for the price of 6. And even the 6, there's war what you have to pay. You get 8 bottles for a reduced 6. Pepsi-Cola gives you not 8 bottles, 6 bottles. What's the difference? All year long, the bottles are 1.5 liters. For Pesach, it is 2 liters for the price of the 1.5 liter bottle. So I want to tell any Jews listening, it's another simple reason, la'alot arza b'rina, kom miyut. Maybe we'll come back to that later. Okay. Now, another tremendous problem which went to the OU, this takes time. It's the teething process. You have a new concept, a new organization, a new responsibility, and you have to know how to handle it. Tell me, where do you look for an OU? You look for an OU on a national product. On a local product, do you look for an OU? And you see, this leads to one of the tremendous heartache problems that the OU had. And Dafka, they had it in Miami Beach. And as a result of 2 incidents that happened a few years apart, all in the 50s, the OU made the decision not to get involved on a local level. Why was Miami Beach so important? Miami Beach, who heard of Miami Beach? Any of you who still remember the 30s, the 40s, Miami Beach, all right, different part of the world, doesn't interest us. Following World War II, planes start to fly commercially on a very wide level. And Miami Beach, which seems so far away, is suddenly a 3-hour flight, a 3.5-hour flight. That's before the jets. I don't have to tell you, with jet age, it's, what is it, 2 hours away, 1 hour and 40 minutes away. Wow, Miami Beach. Go down to Miami Beach. And this already began in the 50s. It's the center of the Jewish world. You walk, have you ever been? I've been to Miami Beach in the winter. You walk along, you think you're in Muncie, you think you're in Williamsburg, you think you're in Geula, Mea Shearim, Ala, Shana, Frumi, Yitten. Wow, big buildings, Shabbos elevators, the works, stores, kosher food, stuff coming in from Bottle Park. You lack for nothing, center of the world. So these Jews already coming in from the greater New York area had standards. And in Miami Beach, it had a Vada Kashrut. A Vada Kashrut that had some conservative rabbis on it. And these conservative rabbis, it was an era yet when these conservative rabbis were makpid on Shabbat and Kashrut. Yes, their shoes, we've said so many times, take down the mechitza, put the men and women together, and we'll hold on to the next generation. And tremendous battle broke out in the 50s, Miami Beach. Are you allowed to have a Vad HaKashrit with conservative rabbis? And this problem, when it happened in Miami Beach and the Rabbanim started to give opinions, it turned out that you had many other areas in the United States where you had conservative rabbis involved. The RCA learned very quickly that they should not be involved. Ultimately, what the RCA did, every community has to decide its own resolution of this question. It could be that if the rabbis are just an advisory committee, but the hashgacha per se is in the hands of Orthodox people, reliable people, what's wrong with conservative rabbis being on the Vat HaKashrut? If anything, it adds strength to the Vat HaKashrut. It adds strength to the kosher produce that you're trying to sell. And ultimately, that's what the RCA did. They totally withdrew. And until today, the RCA policy is not to get involved with local Vadot of Kashrut. What is local? What is national? So more than once, when the RCA discussed this problem, they said, we can depend upon the Rabbanim and the OU. They will understand what is local, what is national. You can't set fast guidelines that are inflexible. A few years later, there was another problem in Florida, and this involved the Schlachtois, where their meat is coming from. And it was a battle royal because Rabbi Lazer Silva and his son-in-law, Rabbi Gershuni, if you remember the name, their meat was coming in and an RCA rabbi was accepting it. And the Vat HaKashrut felt that that supplier was not good enough, and they had their own supplier, and that too became a battle royal, which led to the RCA making Dreizich Ayre Keppel. How do you say that in English? Get involved with your own heads, Dreizich. Wave your heads around, find your own solution. Don't get a national body involved. A problem which haunted the RCA, and I alluded to, and this problem haunts us until today, and I'll show you where it became insoluble, is what do you do with hotels? What do you do with Shabbat? You can give the finest hashgacha to a hotel, but what do you do with Shabbat? This came to the forefront in Atlantic City. Atlantic City, which is not that far from New York, and you should know, before airplane travel, today Atlantic City, Lichtendred, I mean, I don't know if you, I don't know if you know what's going on, but before there was wide airplane travel that made Miami a beach house for New York, Atlantic City, an hour and a half away from New York by bus, that's where the Jews went during the winter. Atlantic City became the center for conventions. Filled with Jews, filled with the Hasidic Jews at first. The Rav of Atlantic City, Rav Moshe Shapiro, his Hashgacha, and there was one tremendous hotel at Atlantic City that was strictly kosher, the Chelsea. What made the Chelsea very unique was a large auditorium. You could have a convention, you could have thousands of people. Under Hashgacha, they could never get the hotel to be totally Shomer Shabbos. What's again the problem? Okay. They could never get the hotel to be totally Shomer Shabbos. They worked out, this is like an Israeli solution, that, they worked out that you don't check in at the main desk, that if you come Shabbos, you go around the side. They set up a special place where you could check in on Shabbos. They said that the waiters wouldn't be Jewish. Remember, this is a time where every Jewish kid made a living working as a waiter on in a hotel. It was still that way in the 60s, the 50s. I still remember Jewish kids, my own classmates, the kids who needed money to pay their tuition, whose parents couldn't afford it, kids who were orphaned. I had a classmate like that. Oh, they were waiters during the summer, made a lot of money. And here you had Jewish waiters, just like in Israel, taking your orders on Shabbos. In Yerushalayim, I have to say, the hotels, that was Rabbi Zsolti, cleaned it up. It's all Arab waiters, which is good or bad, I don't know. But you don't find Jews taking orders. And outside of Yerushalayim, I've been to hotels. You're walking in, they're checking you off. There's a Jew at work. I remember they asked me my room number in Caesarea. I think I told you I refused to give it. I said, that Yehudiya, vat kotevet b'Shabbat, ani lo yechol liot shutaf lezeh, chas v'chalila. All right, they look at you like you're nuts, crazy, you're a non-democratic person and a fanatic. And what can they do? They figure they hear the American accent, so you must be a guest, not someone playing a game with the hotel. But this problem, and it went on with other hotels in the Catskills. Ultimately, it's an insoluble problem. You're giving hashgacha on the kashrut. You're not giving hashgacha on the Sabbath observance. Another problem which came up, which is not a problem today, and this really is funny. In March 1952, the famous Jewish comedian, Eddie Cantor, sent a circular letter recommending Welch's kosher Passover wine, praising its flavor and attesting that it was strictly kosher. Quote, "My wife Ida and I will serve it this Passover." And this caused a tremendous storm. RCA is having a meeting. We have one of the famous Rabbonim of the time, Rabbi Berlian, gets up. And this is the first time, to my knowledge, that a famed entertainer has attempted to give a verdict of religious endorsement to the kashrut of a product. And my wife, Ida, and I, and you don't know what this caused, because immediately Welch Wine sued the RCA. You had no right to say that. We have hashgacha. Rabbi Klavan was hysterical. He told off Rabbi Berlian, never make a statement like that without consulting our attorney, without consulting our lawyer. And Rabbi Abraham Shulson of Erie, Pennsylvania, I know the family, I knew the rabbi, sent the membership a copy of his letter where he said he was giving the endorsement and the Kashrut Commission had approved it. And he was furious that the storm was caused and it's Kashrut and his Kashrut. And this was with the Hashgacha of the OU, and he's not doing it on a personal level. And they're finding fault with it. And he quoted Rabbi Simcha Levi, who also claimed it was mutta. And all right, they had to withdraw their comment. They had to apologize. Eddie Cantor and his wife have the right to say they're using a kosher wine, adarabba v'adarabba. And suddenly it quieted down. But they never gave hashgacha again to Welch. Why? What happened? And Rabbi Bernstein relates the incident. What happened was very simple. From the time the original RCA commission met and authorized Rabbi Shulson, he can give the hashgacha, Rabbi Yosef Weiss, and now Rabbi Yosef Weiss, who we've mentioned many times, wrote a tshuva that you can't give hashgacha. What was the issue? You know what's amazing here? This is an issue that 99% of from Jews today are mekil. What's the first thing we do when we're buying wine? And we know our, you know, what used to be the world that was, we had our cousins coming from the United States. Cousins, second cousins, third cousins, in my case, first cousins. This is Nishke Blibin Abrekali Yiddishkeit with them. My family is in America 120 years. My wife's family is in America 150 years. Nothing remained of Torah with them. Nothing. So, Mechalalei Shabbos, you're worried stiff. First thing you look on the label of the wine, Yayin Mevushal. Yayin Mevushal, all right. It's not the finest wines. I understand the finest wines that you have to be a connoisseur. They can't do pasteurization or bishul for the wines. It takes away from the taste. But we simple Jews, 90% of the wine being sold in the world today is Yayin Mevushal. And we buy it and everyone drinks it and we're happy and Jew and Mechalos Shabbos, etc. No problem, Yayin Mevushal. My dear students, it turns out Welsh was using Yayin Mevushal. Once it's Mevushal, all the Goyim and all the Welsh family and all the non-Jews can play with the wine, can manufacture the wine, can touch the wine, and there's nothing wrong with it. Rabbi Weiss's tshuva upset the apple cart. Tell me, so many years later, this past Pesach, I think it was first this past Pesach, you can correct me, could be a year before already. No, what was the big advertisement? Who got married? Manischewitz wine married Welch grape juice, and they produced the grape juice for Pesach, classic Welch grape juice, Manischewitz label, 100% kosher, Yayin Mevushal, no problem whatsoever. So you see, we've come full cycle. And we have to go back to Eddie Cantor and Ida and offer them an apology. Oh, we're proud that they drank kosher wine on Pesach. Okay. We now arrived at one of the most difficult moments that happened. And I was an ear and eye witness to it. And I have to say, the memory is very, very fresh in my mind. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'hakol nihyeh bedvaro. By 1954, the Rav was the Rav. Now, what do I mean by that? I've explained many times. People don't realize what the Rav went through. In the 30s, the immigrant Boston, I once spoke in Boston, and I'll never forget, I spoke about the Rav, his heartache, the Kashrik accusations, and two elderly gentlemen came over to me. They were, wie kennt euch, wie kennt sie, es outstars, mir haben gewend bei dabei. Oh, but du bist an Amerikaner, how do you know what went on in the 30s? We were there, we saw, we experienced. You're a youngster, a young American. How do you know this? I told them from my research. But by the 50s, the Rav was the Rav. This little classroom at Yeshiva University, where he succeeded his father, giving his first shiur in May of 1941, from that little classroom, he became the Rav, influencing the entire Torah world until this very moment. I need not tell you that the whole conflict over Rav Melamed, which has become major today, we mentioned him in class. No one knew his name. If I mention him in class, he becomes the focal point. If I have time, I'll show you some of the weekend papers. So Rav Melamed, who does he quote to justify his meeting with the talking to that reform rabbi, lady rabbi, Paris? The Rav does articles, entire articles appeared. Now they translate it into English. It appears on Rut Sheva in English. The Rav is the Rav. So in YU, we knew who the Rav was already, and we pressured him. It's before Pesach, addressed the student body. So right before Pesach, 1954, the Rav gives a shiur on Pesach, on the Haggadah. And this is the Rav Kadako Bakodesh. And I already was, 1954, I was a mature high school kid who thought he knew everything, right? And I went to hear the Rav, and I can never forget it. The Rav Taka gives a shiur. And at the end of the shiur, the Rav opens it to questions. So someone from the audience shoots out, Rebbe, Tom Minutzin, corn syrup, Pesach Zeit. Can we use corn syrup on Pesach? Everything was in Yiddish yet. And the Rav said, no, it's a machlege, but me and Nutzen das nicht. Says, yeah, it's a well-known machlege. Corn syrup is a legume derivative. A legume we don't use, Ashkenazim. Why we don't use it, a great deal has been written on it. Until today, we're not certain why we don't use legumes. My own life experience and being in the Israeli army and cleaning out the rice for Pesach, so my own life experience tells me that probably the reason we don't use legumes because fields where crops are growing are near each other. And you can have wheat growing and wheat, barley, whatever it is, the wind carries it over to another field. And there you'll have in the middle of corn, in the middle of peas, there'll be a drop of wheat, a drop of barley. And that's why the minig began not to use legumes on Pesach. I may be right, I may be wrong, we'll never know for sure. But that's what it would seem to me, because I know when you clean the rice, how you clean it and what the svadim do, and how you look for something that's not white, and you know already it's been blown in from another field, another crop. So corn syrup, the shaila is, what can't you use? Is it only the legume per se, or is it legume derivatives as well? And this is open to question. And for instance, in parts of Poland, they did use legume derivatives. In Lithuania, they did not. And the Rav said, near Nutzen, that we don't use it. So this young man shot back from the audience, no, I've been tarnished, was he mit Bartens? Our good friends Bartens pops up again. They now have the OU. And the Rav says, was may, what does this mean? And they tell the Rav that Bartens candy has corn syrup in it on Pesach. Well, we walked away and, you know, question, answers, everything forgotten. We thought this was like on a Tuesday night. The word went around all of New York that Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, Rabbi Soloveitchik, said Barton's candy cannot be eaten on Pesach. It has corn syrup. Thursday morning, I remember it like yesterday, outside Dr. Belkin's office, the original building, main academic center, the building dedicated 1928 Hanukkah time, right outside Dr. Belkin's office, right where you walk in, you turn to your right, walk up the steps, there's Dr. Belkin's office. Conference room, his personal office. Right outside his office, there's Mr. Klein, two lawyers, and what went on? The Rav, Dr. Belkin, the yeshiva, I need not tell you what's involved here. And the Rav issued a statement that he didn't say, Chas v'chalila, you can't use buttons. He's totally samach totally relies upon the hashgacha of the OU, and everyone can follow what the OU says. Friday morning, there was a quarter page ad in the New York Times. I still remember, maybe someone can look up the ad. It was right here on this right, on the left page, right quarter page. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik declares his total confidence in the supervision of the Union of Orthodox Congregations of Barton's Candy. And obviously, this was quite a lesson for all of us there, including yours truly. Just remember, when you're teaching, when you're speaking publicly, people are listening. And you may not take yourself seriously, but the Olam does. You have to be very careful what you say. Over the decades, anything I've ever said, I can back up. I may not be right. There may be other opinions, but I can justify my point of view. The Rav here was caught in the crossfire, but they found a very elegant solution where he said, I'm samach on the OU. What I can assure you is that the next year they did not use corn syrup. And here they quote the Rav. The Rav wrote Rabbi Klavan regarding the rumors about Barton's Candy. In his lecture, the Rav said he had discussed the various opinions, quote, I didn't decide in discussion and didn't prohibit anything. I said that every rabbi should decide for himself. What I remember hearing was, in Litter haben wir nicht genutzt. This I heard with my own ears. And of course, people, the Rav says, Lithuania, who are we? We're learning with the Rav, Lithuanians, all right. Nowadays, I don't believe the OU would give a hashgacha. They would probably give to corn syrup, but they would write in typical Israeli fashion for a Dot HaMizrach. This product is good for a Dot HaMizrach. It's like egg matzahs. If you recall the egg matzahs, so on the side of the box, the hashgacha would read, kosher in accordance with the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. It would all be in Hebrew. However, according to the Ramah, only sick people and children are allowed to use it. I think the word old people also fits in. So you see, at my age, I can get away with eating egg matzahs on Pesach. So Baruch Hashem, Azal Yetzahara Habach Nachnisht, I don't have. But it is true, I eat egg matzahs before Pesach. And it is true that on the Shabbos following Pesach, when we have a Yontif Sheni here, so I brought egg matzah, and I don't know, all my grandchildren have complaints against matzah. It's not filling, it's not good, it's torture to eat and whatnot. And I give them egg matzah. And believe it or not, they're moida that egg matzah, this already we could tolerate. All the matzah would taste like egg matzah. All right. Let me go one step further. And this will end off our discussion of kashrut. But this brings to mind something that I remember as a kid. In New York, and by the way, all over where there were large slaughterhouses, you had unions, mamish unions that were part of the greater Union C. They were caught up with whatever the AFL or et cetera, and they had a number, and these were unions. They were powerful. In the New York area, the most powerful union of the Mashkichim was headed by a Jew known as Reb Yehuda Horowitz, Judah Horowitz, H-U-R-W-I-T-Z. Everyone called him Chaim Yudel. His name was Chaim Yehuda Horowitz, and everyone called him Chaim Yudel. And there was always ongoing rechilit that he's too powerful and they're too demanding and they're not reliable. There was always a bit of tension between the OU RCA and the New York Kashrut Supervisors Union. It was a union that they should get paid properly, shouldn't have to work extra, too many extra hours. And this went on for years. But finally, a major issue came along where RCA and the Kashrut Union worked hand in hand. And I have to tell you, it was during Rabbi Rachman's presidency, and he wrote to Rabbi Klavan, "You too will have to suffer with me. For whatever months, I will yet hold office. But everyone has his phobias. I have mine. I do not ever become addicted to rumors and hearsay. And on the basis of my experience with Rabbi Hurwitz, I have only the highest praise for him." Now, what was the issue that Rabbi Chaim Yudel and Rabbi Rachman and ultimately RCA joined forces? And I would say almost successful entirely until today. All right. My dear students, it's something we would like to forget about. Throughout the United States of America, public dinners were held. Israel celebrates its 10th anniversary. Some local YMHA celebrates its anniversary, its opening, its yearly dinner. Generally speaking, lo aleinu, these dinners were not kosher. Could you imagine Jewish dinners, dinners for Israel? These dinners were not kosher. It was a reflection of the population. How many Jews who counted? We're not talking about the poor Jews who barely made a living and didn't play any role in the public sphere. We're talking about the Jews who counted, the Jews who had money, the Jews who did things, philanthropy. How many gave a hoot about kashrut? And these public dinners were not kosher. Chaim Yudel led the battle that his sheikhdom, his mashkichim yelled, shouted, picketed, picketed. How many rabbis were willing to go picket outside a dinner celebrating the 10th anniversary of the State of Israel, which was not a kosher dinner? Could you imagine? How many rabbis were willing to go? And the mashgichim, they picketed. This is a union. Their boss gave the order. They picketed, they yelled, they shouted. As a result, slowly but surely, all over the United States, today there's recognition. A dinner that has to do with a Jewish institution has to be kosher. The State of Israel, it's part of the protocol of the foreign ministry that any public affair for the state has to be kosher. You have no idea what an achievement this is. And Rabbi Rachman fought a tremendous battle. He said some of the people spat in his face. He tells the story. The American Jewish Committee said, all right, we'll be kosher. Who did they call upon to give them kashrut? The Reconstructionist Rabbinical Organization. It was spitting in the face of the Orthodox Jews. But that was then. Today, they would not get away with it. But Rabbi Rachman, may I play with words, who hechshir at Reb Yudel Horowitz. He fought, he picketed, and as Rabbi Rachman said, I had only the highest regard for him. So my dear students, these were great achievements. Not everything can be solved 100% to our satisfaction. There's no question that the Chilul Shabbos troubles every Jew, but at least we knew with the Kashrut we could depend upon the OU. And this is the history of the OU. You have to bow your head humbly that the RCA and the OU, they gave up individual hashgacha, they gave up their own private bank accounts, and for the common good, they surrendered to the OU. The story with Barasini's Bartons is a sad story. The story lives on. I can show you. This is from Atlantic Magazine, April 15th, 2009. Beautiful candies are being shown right before your eyes. And what do you think the story is entitled? The Kosher Chocolate War. And it's the whole story about Bartons and Barasini. And here's the death of the one individual who really cared, Mac Barasini, 51, co-founder of Chain of Jewish Causes and Barasini Candy, New York Times obituary, July 19th, 1956. With his death, it ameliorated the problem because Barasini's was no longer interested in meeting the standards that the OU was gradually leading them to. But it's a sad story of outside influence. And I, over the years, I remember speaking with some of the famous Rabbanim who were involved at the time, and there was acclamation that it was a bad mistake. They should have immediately told Bartons, our job is to give as much hashgacha as possible. We would proudly say that you're not just kosher, you're Shomer Shabbos. We are proud of it, but it doesn't mean we can't give hashgacha to other candy manufacturers. But that was a moment in time, a moment of power. Bartons, the OU is not yet what it is today. And it's a sad story. It's called the blackest moment in the history of the OU Hashgacha and the RCA's input. So where does this take us? We've seen many years now the history of Torah in the United States. We've seen how Agudas HaRabbanim ruled the new generation, the 1920s, the English-speaking rabbinate, and by the 1950s, post-World War II, RCA is on the map. Lamala Lamala, the Europeische rabbis, not Rashi Yeshiva, Lamata Lamata. What comes next are two tremendous battles that the RCA fights, battles that it's all part of the development of so-called centrist orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy, YU, RCA, OU, Young Israel, Torah. Battles on two different sides. One side, conservative Judaism. Bigger than ever, more powerful than ever. The Judaism of the suburbs, Marshall Sklar's famous book, Social Scientist. The perfect answer to what the United States is all about. Ethnic origins and culture multiplicity. Conservative Judaism, I'm a Jew. I daven a little bit in Hebrew, part in English. I'm not ashamed of my ethnic origins. I'm not a Reformed Jew. But I'm proud to be part of America. Liberalism, innovation, feminism. Perfect synthesis. And boy, they were powerful. Tremendous battle on that side. And on the other side, post-World War II, the swing to the right. The Rashi Yeshiva, the Hasidic Rebbeim. What? RCA? Why you? Das heißt nicht Frumkeit. That's not Judaism. Sit with Reformed conservative rabbis? Chas v'chalila. Oh, what goes on? Oh, God should give strength, and I should be able to go further. Chodesh Elul, and that's what we open up with. After that, I got to be honest. I'm not Artscroll. I'm Aaron Rekefet. I'm a Talmud of the Rav. Intellectual honesty. Jay Solomon knows very well that if you weren't intellectually honest, the Rav would eat you up alive. Teira Vidas, Mr. Mendelovich, Torah Mesorah. And then I have to be intellectually honest. The Satma Ruv, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. What I've just described to you is like another 5 years of lectures. God should give strength. But give me a minute. Yomo, put that there. Okay. Can I make a few comments so that I earn my keep for teaching? Take a look. This is Rabbi Eliezer Melamed. We mentioned him in class. Very few heard of his name. He suddenly, Kach hafach Rabbi Eliezer Melamed l'dmut ha-toranit ha-mashpia b'tzionut ha-datit. Tremendous article here on who he is, the way he thinks. Tremendous article in Besheva, translated into English. So I'm proud to say I mentioned the person, and a week later, he entered the limelight. I also want to mention two svarim that when I finished, one I'm in the middle of, and I highly recommend. This is put out by Yad Vashem. Its title is Bein Shem Lakan, Kovnev Eretz Yisrael. It's by Safira Rappaport. It catches everything. If you really want to understand what went on in the Holocaust, what went on, her mother was the daughter of one of the famous Rabbanim of Slabodka, a good friend of the lady who later becomes the wife of Reb Yitzchak Sher of Slabodka in Israel, a good friend of the wife of Rav Volpi, and what they went through in the Holocaust and how the mother loses her emunah lo aleinu, which we can understand, unfortunately. And what Eretz Yisrael means, and what this girl, this written by the daughter growing up here in Eretz Yisrael, and what she went through as a second generation survivor. I have to tell you, it taught me one thing that I now understand. I used to lecture in the army. One of my popular lectures was dealing with the Holocaust, the Shoah. And I used to begin with a simple question. Here we are wearing the uniform of the Israeli army. Here we are proud soldiers. Here we are surrounded by so many tanks and planes, depended on the base I was in. And I would say, and these Jews, 6 million, Hayim Haim Hayu Kemotzon Hamuvala Tevach, were they like sheep being led to slaughter? And I used that as a jumping point for my lecture. And I always, everyone would jump forward. I learned from this book that this poor girl, when she went to school in Ramat Gan, the students made fun of her because they said, where you came from, they went like sheep to slaughter. And wow, did I start to understand in retrospect how timely the lectures I had developed on the Holocaust were. And then she goes back to Kovna, she goes back to the camps. It's a fascinating volume. You learn, you feel the period. I would love to meet with this lady. She, her sister and brother survived with miracles. I mean, you have to read it. Their mother dies. The father was in Baltimore raising funds for Slabodka. And he survives because he was in Baltimore when the war broke out. And what a fascinating volume. It was published by Yad Vashem in 2004, 16 years ago. So if anyone knows a Sephira Rappaport who lived in Yerushalayim at the time, please let me know. A very wonderful volume that just came out. Moshe Arendt, Shivim Panim LeTorah. How do I know Moshe Arendt? We taught together in Michlala for many years. I knew him very well. Great expert in Chumash, Pashanut HaMikra. He early years spent in Breuers. That was the Hirschian school in Frankfurt, the city of his birth. And what a volume, a collection of his writings, of his publications, his memoirs, his testimony before Yad Vashem, and some of the correspondence. I already can tell you, I found in the correspondence last night new material that I already added to my lectures on Rav Menashe Klein when we begin next year. But I found this volume so fascinating, describing his youth in Frankfurt. I'll tell you one story. It goes back to my lectures 20, 30 years ago when I spoke about the German Jewry. So there were two kehillot in Frankfurt, like in every big city. One was the Gemeinde, the general kehillah, which sat with the Reform and with the non-Orthodox as well. And one was the Alstritt of Rav Hirsch, which was simply Orthodox. So he went to school in Rav Hirsch, and he davened in the strictly Orthodox, the Alstritt community. One time his ball, they were playing ball near the Gemeinde Schule, and the ball went over the fence. And he wanted to jump in. He told his mother that the next day he'll jump over the fence and get the ball. And his mother said, absolutely not. You're not allowed to go in to that property of the house of the Gemeinde Schule. And he had to ask the janitor to get the ball and bring it to him. Later on, he found out his father was a member of both schools, the Alstritt and the Gemeinde. And he asked, why were you so anti here? Daddy belongs to both schools. And his parents explained to him that really they feel the Gemeinde Schule is the correct approach, that that which divides, that which unites us is much more important than that which divides us. But his parents felt the chinuch was better in the Hirschian system. So since he went to Breuers and he was part of the Hirschian system, they felt it's not right to jump in and show you also have allegiance, at least in public, with the Gemeinde Schule. Be loyal to the education you are receiving. And it's a fascinating volume. He runs away to France, a little kid. He parts, never realizing that will be the last time he'll see his mother. It's so sad. It breaks the heart. And it leads me to the question that haunts me. maybe I should get in a plane and drop a hydrogen bomb on Germany. Maybe I should do that. But I can't do it. You know why? Because among the people you'll kill, you're going to kill Germans who saved Jews, who cared for Jews. They were not the majority, but they were there. And that's why we can't do things like just take revenge. No, it can't be done. We have to look for the good, as bad as the evil is. What I would do, if Germany says a word that we declare Gush Etzion part of Israel, we should yell loud and clear. And where were you during World War II? Loud and clear to Britain. Where were you during World War II? Loud and clear to all the other countries that danced on Jewish blood, Hashem Yerachem. So anyway, I recommend these two volumes. There's a lot to read, and it's overwhelming how much you can learn from memoir literature. It opens your mind to what they felt 70, 80 years ago. And I was so happy how I would begin in the army. Shtzon hayuval letevach. Haim ze kein? Haim ze kacha? Ma yitachein? Ma hevdel? Lama anachnu mitgaim? Tzva hagana li Yisrael? Visham eza son shisham milyonim. And believe me, I answered the question. I did it in the kollel. Maybe it's online, but what can we do? We can't do everything all at once. Morty, what do we call today's lecture? Bartons versus Barasini. So I think Barasini's has to come first. It's B-A-R. Bartons, B-A-R. Barasini, I-T. Barasini's versus Bartons. World War III. My dear students, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, honoring me with your presence. It's with a heavy heart we leave, because we don't know what's going to be, but we're all caught up with it. We're not any wiser than our brilliant politicians who make fools out of themselves in public, fighting the Misrata B'riah. You have to make a decision and don't tell us you're chopping each other one's heads off. But we're no wiser than America. They don't know what to do there either. So we can only turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He should have mercy upon us, for the tzaddikim among us, al tzaddikim, al chassidim, al zikneim, chabet Yisrael, v'al pleitat sofreihem, and give us a refuah. But one way or another, we will start up again in Chodesh Elul. And Mori, I'll be in touch with you, and you'll let everyone know. B'yitziyatom mahu ameh, finishing 61 years of teaching, it's not a small matter. Modani lefanecha, denoy Elohai velohei avotai, shesamta chalki miyoshvei beit hamedrash, velo samta chalki miyoshvei kranot, shani mashkim vechei mashkimim, ani mashkim levdivirei toda, vechei mashkimim ledvarim betailim, ani amel vechei mamalim, אני אמל ומקבל שכה, והם אמלים ואינו מקבלים שכה. אני רץ והם רצים. אני רץ לחיי העולם הבא, והם רצים לבשחת. שנאמה, ואתם אלוהים תורידים לבשחת. אנשי דמים וממה לא יחצו ימיהם, ואני אפתח בך. And let that be said on the Germans and all that went along with them, with gusto, with lo aleinu, what happened to our people. Mori, please open. So let me just say, until we meet again, in health and happiness, das vidanya. Mori, open it for questions.